Afriki de nu wilila kaye wa senayala yoro janta mala yalla yalla ani fenyini ni ma fensoro ina fenyi.
It's Sunday afternoon and time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host Jeff Davis. If you're going to be in the neighborhood next weekend, beginning I think on Thursday night, I hope you'll check out some of WordFest 2009, the poetry festival that actually grew out of Wordplay here. It's going to bring a diversity of poets and poetics to Asheville. Some of their work I know, some of them I don't know, but I'm going to check out as many as I can. One of the poets last year in the inaugural WordFest, whose work I came really, really to enjoy, was the performance poet Patricia Smith. She joins a long list since time immemorial of language performance artists like Asheville's own Glynis Redmond. She's a modern-day griot, a teller of tales who wears many masks. In our first selection today, she's reading at WordFest, for WordFest at UNCA's Humanities Lecture Hall almost exactly a year ago. 24th of April, 2008.
Thank you so much. This is interesting because I kind of got to be a eavesdropper as a lot of the WordFest stuff was going on. And already, and this is the first night, it's already a legendary achievement, and I have to do this one more time, because it feels great to be here. I start all my readings out with the same poem, and I've tried to stop and do some other things, but I realize I do it because it roots me and reminds me of why I write poetry in the first place, so I'm going to do it again here. I used to do residency in Miami with a group of sixth graders, and the area had a high incidence of drug use, so a lot of the kids had lost parents or brothers and sisters to AIDS, and I came bounding in saying, I'm here to teach you poetry, and they're saying, well, you got to make our lives a little bit better first. And there was a little girl there whose mother had died the week before, and she was already back in school. So I do this poem because she asked me to help her write a poem for her mother. And I do it because it reminds me of how language has the power to take us from one place in our head to a safer place, which is what she was asking me to help her do. So this is dedicated to the sixth grade class at Lily C. Evans Elementary School in Dade County, Miami, which they made me promise to say every time I did the poem. I am astonished at their mouthful names, Lacanicia, Chevalane, DeLeo, Fumaleo, their ragged rebellions and lip gloss pouts and all those pants drooped as drapery. I rejoice when they kiss my face, whisper wet and urgent in my ear, make me their obsession because I have brought them poetry. They shout me raw, bruise my wrist with their pulling, and brashly claim me as mama as they cradle my head in their little laps, waiting for new words to grow in my mouth. You, you, you. Angry, jubilant, weeping poets, we are all saviors, reluctant hosannas in the limelight. But you knew that, didn't you? So let us bless this sixth grade class. 40 cracking voices, 40 nappy heads, and all of them raise their hands when I ask. They have all seen the Reaper, grim in his heavy robe, pushing the button for the dead project elevator, begging for a break at the corner pawn shop, cackling wildly in the back pew of the Baptist church. I ask the death question, and 40 fists punch the air. Me! Me! An O'Neill matchstick crack child watched his mother's body become a claw. And 9-year-old Tico Jefferson, barely big enough to lift the gun, fired a bullet into his throat when Mama bended his back with a lead pipe. Tamika cried into a sofa pillow when Daddy blasted Mama into the north wall of their cluttered one-room apartment. Danya's cousin, gone in a drive-by, dark window, click, click, gone, says Danya, her tiny finger a barrel, the thumb a hammer. I am astonished at their losses. And yet when I read a poem about my own hard-eyed teenager, Jeffrey asks, is he dead yet? Cannot be comprehended. My 18-year-old still pushing and pulling his own breath. And 40 faces pity me, knowing that I will soon be as they are, numb to our bloodied histories, favoring the reaper with a thumbs up and a wink, hearing the question and shouting, me, me, Miss Smith, I know somebody dead. Can poetry hurt us, they ask me, before crawling into my words to sleep. I love you, Nicole says. Nicole wearing my face, pimples peppering her nose, and she is as black as angels are. Nicole's braids kissed with match flame to seal them. And can you teach me to write a poem about my mama, Miss Smith? I mean, you write about your daddy, and he's dead. Can you teach me to remember my mama? A teacher tells me this is the first time Nicole has admitted that her mother is gone. Murdered by slim silver needles and a stranger rifling through her blood, the virus pushing her skeleton through for Nicole to see. And now this child with rusty knees and mismatched shoes sees poetry as her scream and asks me for the words to build her mother again, replacing the voice, stitching on the lost flesh. So poets, as we take the stage, as we flirt and sin and rejoice behind microphones, remember Nicole. She knows that we are here now, and she is an empty vessel waiting to be filled. And she is waiting. And she's waiting. And she waits.
I have a 12-year-old granddaughter who lives with me. And I've tried to think of some delicate way to say this, but I can't. So when her period began, she would be so horrified if she was here. We had a party, invited about 10 of her friends over, and we had red feather boas, and they all wore red, and we danced. I figured they might as well celebrate now. It was fun. Half of them didn't know they were dancing about, but we figured out. And it started me thinking about the role of blood in women's lives. So I thought about me and my husband and I and Michaela, it's my granddaughter's name. So this is called the Blood Sonnets. One, me, age 12. Sure that I was dying, that I died, that the gush of iron smell and black thick splash signaled all my sin gone wide, I pried open the thin wobbly back of a record cabinet and crammed my underwear inside. My mother had told me nothing about my body, damned to swell, sprout hair, creak, and bleed toward old, so I hid the stiff soiled Carters there among the music. Wedged wrong in all that bladed jazz and blues I didn't dare dance to. Gangly child, I was still small but too plumped to rest in my mama's lap. Stashing my music, I braced for her slap. Two, you and I, too long ago. Brash, adulterous fools, you and I clash in a rented bed. This tryst ill-conceived, the longed-for coupling off by days. I bleed so much it seems a kill has taken place, my body grieving its harbor of woman. But do we slow, think, push apart, stop? No. Believing this chaos faded, we're slow to see the sheets wide-streaked, scarlet, the fat drops peppering carpet, my thighs burned red until you deadpan. Let's call the cops. Looks like murder. Somebody must be dead. Spent in the midst of our vicious crime, we phone our other lives and we lie about the time. Three, Michaela, yesterday. The purplish clot fascinated you, didn't it? The way it woke you and trembled in your jammies like a clue you hadn't asked for. You slid your hand inside the cleft, wiggled fingers stained with, "New me, Grandma." We rose that night and sistered for hours. Questions reigned. Where's the egg? And answers were your right and my relief. I took final stock. Age 11, size 10 feet, my height. Oh God, my girl, my woman, the shock of sweet you lurching forward just might kill me. Let's ignore the creeping sands. Let's laugh and clasp each other's bloody hands. Thanks. One of the things Alan mentioned was that, you know, I got a push cart prize this past. thank you. And people always asking me, I do a lot of readings where there's a question and answer. So, you know, the students have their notebooks and they say, "Can you tell us how you crafted the award-winning poem? And step by step, could you talk us through it?" And okay, here's what happened. I was at an airport and I was in line at Starbucks. And a pilot came and got in line in front of me. He didn't say, "Get out of my way, dog." He didn't say, "Excuse me." He said nothing. He just kind of looked down at me like I was about this big, and he just like got in line in front of me. And it started me thinking about pilots, you know, how they walk through the airports. You know, it's like, please, whatever. So I got on the plane, and I started writing about how I felt about pilots. So then I had done this one gig in Atlanta, and they were putting an anthology together, and they asked me for a poem. And I was like, you know how you kind of don't really want to give them a poem? So I look at my little notebook, and I saw this thing, and I wrote it out real fast, and I go, "Oh, the way pilots walk." And that is the poem. they nominated that, and that was the poem. So this is it. This is the award-winning important work. The literary discourse shall begin after I read this. Okay, I better change a word in here. Okay.
Radio.
Okay. The way pilots walk. God, what's another word for that? Okay. The way pilots walk. Like their privates, and haunches are heavy with it. Past Starbucks and baggage claim, arrogant past flinching monitors and the sea gates, pilots stride navy and crease, chiseled heads swiveling in bare tolerance of we, the ground bound. Their faces are chapped by a higher sun, their pompadours glossy and blade sliced. They live huge lives awfully close to heaven where blessings begin. How smug are those little hats, dripping with mysterious metals, shaped like a salute to the men beneath them. We bear bowed, pissed witness to their dismissive sniffs, the oh-so-holier-than-thou clank in their hips. There's no bound script for that sexy instance when the wide sky inhales their laughable machines and folds their hurtling heartbeats into the blue. Go on, join the club. Envy their asses and pray towards them. Every flyboy is your fate wearing a crisp little uniform. A quirk of pulse, a sleepless night, a flick of his wrist could kill you and 100 other yous. And maddening as it may be, there's just no answer to that strut. It says, "Damn you, I've got the air."
Thank you.
Oh, I'm still kind of in a really good mood here. So, okay, this is called "My Mother Learns English." My mother, I called her once a while ago, and she said, "I can't talk long. I'm going to my English lesson," and I'd hung up the phone, and I went, "Wait a minute! My mother knows how to speak English." So that's that's this fall. One, Jittery immigrant at 64, my mother is learning English. Pulling rubbery cinnamon-tinged hose to a roll beneath her knees, sporting one swirling Baptist ski slope of a hat, she rides the rattling elevator to a Windy City spire and pulls back her gulp as the elevator hurtles towards heaven. Then she's stiffly seated at a scarred oak table across from a white government-sanctioned savior who has dedicated 8 hours a week to straightening afflicted black tongues. She guides my mother patiently through lazy ings and errs, slowly scraping her throat clean of the moist and raging infection of Aliceville, Alabama. There are barely muttered apologies for colored sounds. There is much beginning again. I want to talk right before I die. Want to stop saying ain't and I done been like I ain't got no sense. I'm a grown woman. I didn't live too long to be so stupid, acting like I just got off the boat. My mother has never been on a boat. But 50 years ago, merely a million of her, clutching strapped cases, Jets Emmett Till issue, and thick peppered chicken wings in waxed bags, stepped off hot rumbling buses at northern stations in Detroit, in Philly, in the bricked cornfield called Chicago. Brushing stubborn scarlet dust from their shoes, they said, "We're north now." Slinging it in backdoor syllable as if those three words were vessels big enough to hold country folks' overwrought ideas of light. Two. Back then, my mother thought it a modern miracle, this new living in a box stacked upon other boxes where every flat surface reeked of Lysol and effort, and chubby roaches, cross-eyed with spray, dragged themselves across freshly washed dishes and dropped dizzy from the ceiling into our Murphy beds, our wash tubs, our open steaming pots of green. Of course, there was a factory just two bus rides close, a job that didn't involve white babies or blue laundry, where she worked in tense line with other dreamers, repetita, repetita, all those oily, hot-combed heads drooping, no talking as scarred brown hands romanced machines, just the sound of doing it right and juicy fruit cracking. A mere mindset away, there had to be a corner tavern where dead blues men begged for second chances from the juke, and where my mama, perched man-weary on a comfortable stool by the door, could look like a Christian who was just leaving. And on Sunday, at Pilgrim Rest Missionary Baptist Church, she would pull on the pure white gloves of service and wail to the rafters when the Holy Ghost's hot hand grew itchy and insistent at the small of her back. She was his child, finally loosed of that damnable delta, building herself anew in this land of sidewalks, blue jukes, and sizzling fried perch in white boxes. See her. All nap burned from her crown, one gold tooth winking, soft hair riding her lip, blouses starched hard, Orlan sweaters with smatterings of stitched roses, A-line skirts, the colors of unleashed winter. Three. My mother's voice is like homemade cornbread, slathered with butter, full of places for heat to hide. When she is pissed, it punches straight out and clears the room. When she is scared, it turns practical, matter of fact, like when she called to say, "They found your father this morning. Someone shot him. He's dead. He didn't come to work. I knew something was wrong." When Mama talks, the southern swing of it is sugar and wild with unexpected blooms, like the fields she never told me about in Alabama. Her rap is peppered with ain't gots and I done bins and he bees, just like mine is when I'm color among color. During worship, when talk becomes song, it's her voice that collapses and loses all acquaintance with key. So of course, she's the fractured alto wailing above everyone, uncaged, unapologetic, and creaking toward heaven. Now she wants to sound proper when she gets there. A woman got some sense and future need to upright herself, talk English instead of talking wrong. It's strange to hear the precise rote of Annie Pearl's new mouth.
She slips sometimes, but she is proud of when she remembers to bite down on dirt-crafted contractions and double negatives. Sometimes I wonder whatever happened to the warm expanse of the red dust woman who arrived with a little sin in all the good wrong words. I dream her breathless, maybe leaning forward a little in her seat on the Greyhound. "I ain't never seen," she begins, grinning through the grime at Chicago, city of huge shoulders, thief of tongue.
Thank you.
I was going to end with something that wouldn't cause us all to slit our throats. And it's interesting. It's hard to pull out of poems sometimes. So and I have to ask, I have a little poem and then the funny one. Is that okay? It's all right? You sure? Because I have no idea. I didn't know how hurricanes were named, and as soon as I said that, every third grader in the world came up to tell me how. There's an A through Z list every year, and as the hurricanes occur, they check them off. And every 5 years, the list reoccurs. Unless there's been a certain amount of damage or a high death toll, and then they will retire the name forever, so there won't ever be another Hurricane Katrina. But I was looking at the list of names for that year, and Katrina in the book is a woman. She comes in and out of all situations and comments on what she sees and what's going on, and so I started to think of them all as a big family. So these are the hurricanes of 2005. It's called Siblings.
Arlene learned to dance backwards in heels that were too high. Brett prayed for a shaggy mustache made of mud and hair. Cindy just couldn't keep her windy legs together. Dennis never learned to swim. Emily whispered her gust into a thousand skins. Franklin, far-sighted and anxious, bumbled villages. Gert spat her matronly name against the city's flat face. Harvey hurled a wailing child high. Irene, the baby girl, threw pounding tantrums. Jose liked the whip sound of slapping. Lee just craved the whip. Maria's thunder skirts flew high when she danced. Nate was mannered and practical. He stormed precisely. Ophelia nibbled weirdly on the tips of depressions. Felipe slept too late, flailing on a wronged ocean. Rita was a vicious flirt. She woke Felipe with rumors. Stan was born business, a gobbler of steel. Tammy crooned country, getting the words all wrong. Vince died before anyone could remember his name. Wilma opened her maw wide, flashing rot. None of them talked about Katrina. She was their odd sister, the blood dazzler.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me time. For everybody for being here, and thank you all my Asheville friends for all the fun we're gonna have this weekend. No pressure though. Okay, this has a little bit of tiny bit of audience participation. You audience, you participate, that's how it goes. There's this little club in Boston where I used to do poetry, and it's called the Cantab. And at the Cantab, there's a blues jam on the upper floor, and there's a little guy. His name is Little Joe Cook. He's about this high. He's like 80 years old. And if you want to sing in the blues jam, you have to get past Little Joe. You have to convince him that you're good enough to have the stage for 5 minutes. And Little Joe has one song that he's famous for. It's called Peanuts. And if you listen to Oldies Radio enough, you'll hear it. It goes, Peanuts. Oh, Peanuts. Okay. Now, Little Joe sings Peanuts like for an hour and a half.
It's like Peanuts, Peanuts the remix, Peanuts disco version, you know, peanut brittle, you know, peanut butter. He just goes and goes and goes and goes. And he isn't like anybody else to sing Peanuts. Okay, so if you're out in the audience and you're having too good a time and singing too loud, he will shush you. So you have to understand, it's like nobody can sing Peanuts except Little Joe Cook. That is essential to the understanding of this poem. All right, nobody can sing Peanuts but who? Okay, you need to know that. Now, and I have a blues band I perform with sometimes. So this is what we had a ritual where we'd open a bottle of whiskey before every show and we start to talk about fame, what fame was, whether we wanted to be famous, blah, blah, blah. And we knew we weren't going to be famous in that, oh my God, there she is kind of way. So this is about my musings on fame. Every name you hear in here is that you don't recognize is a member of my band. And you know need to know that thing that you now know about Lil Joe. And you need to know that Lil Joe calls women cheese. Burgers. So yeah, so fame. And just imagine my band is behind me because that's what we used to do. Everyone dreams of being famous. We dream of nobly suffering that numbing, insane fame where we can't even get close to ourselves without an all-access pass. We'd like to be so famous that we walk down the street and folks just pass out. I, of course, have already achieved a reputation of note. I'm that Janet Reno, Whitney Houston, Aunt Esther, Hillary Clinton. This was before. This is an old poem. Glad I ain't her kind of famous. But the bottom line is, you ain't, and I is. Famous works that way. Everybody on this stage, and I do believe I'm famous enough to speak for everyone, wants to roll around in that stupid fame. We want to begin autographing skin. We want to sign tits, backbones. We want to change our names to unpronounceable symbols, become the artist formerly known as Modest. We want to sputter foul words, be regularly resuscitated, try on diseases for the tabloids, publicly trash something holy, and thank Jesus, our mama, and Jesus' mama on the MTV Video Awards. We can only hope to be obscenely famous. So famous, it's okay for us to sleep with anyone. The boys with the boys, the girls with the girls, married, virginal, underage, Lebanese, willing, unwilling, because we will be famous enough to break the rules of the world and make everybody wish they could too. We will lie about our ages, our backgrounds. We will tell anyone who asks that we grew up rich and rebelled, grew up poor and excelled, grew up in heaven and got the hell out. We dream of being so out of the box famous that Al Sharpton organizes a march against us and then asks us to march in it. So famous that somebody attempts to assassinate us or kidnaps us and threatens to snip a body part off every hour until we tell them what it takes to be so famous that some pimply-faced kid in Booty Wiggle, Idaho plays our record backwards and picks up a gun. Uh-huh, see? We got big, huge dreams. Everybody on this stage wants the lights to go down and the fireworks to spurt, and we want the stage to dramatically start rising up, up like we're a Kiss, up like the Who, up, up, up like the mothership. We want pyrotechnics and lasers and dry ice and exploding guitars, and we want to drool and dribble and spit like the Rolling Stones. But Lord, don't let's get that old. And Jim wants a drum solo that lasts till Christmas, and we want dun, 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 to play when we come on, and dun, 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 to play when we leave. And Steve, whose dreams are smaller because he's from Canada, Steve wants to smash it. Ooh, oops. Ooh. I didn't even think about it. Steve wants to smash his guitar over someone's head, maybe even his own head, and not get in trouble for it. And Josh dreams about playing that bass so hard that his fingers bleed and the blood drips onto the floor at his feet. And the next day, every newspaper in the world has a front page picture of just the blood on the floor at his feet above the caption, Josh. You guys are good. And Phil, the singer, he wants to pull in a blue note that strikes people blind. He wants you to be willing to sell your soul for the soul he serves you. You must crave him continuously. And he dreams of opening his mouth and stars spilling out. Big, sparkly, pointy things that defy understanding and light up the night sky. He wants to be irrepressibly famous. Number one on the hit parade. He wants Dick Clark to please not get old and die before hearing the best he's ever heard. Phil, dare we say it.
Phil wants to get so crazy famous that he's invited on stage at the Cantab to sing Peanuts with the legendary Little Joe Cook. And sometime during the song, Little Joe says, "Take it, Phil!" That long introduction for that one line. Okay. Phil longs for the day he'll be famous enough to know what it means to call a woman a cheeseburger or a hamburger or any kind of sandwich, whatever. My boys dream big. They want to be canonized like Tupac, misunderstood like Cobain, smelly like Morrison, mowed down like Lennon. They want adoration, unleashed worship, groupies, caviar, and chitlins in the green room. Bigger paychecks, bigger perks, bigger peanut. Me? I dream of writing one word, one single word, that will hurt you, arouse you, cramp your style, kiss you deeply, celebrate you, encourage you, get your panties in a bunch, insult you, sting you, rinse you clean, cage you, make you rant, make you think about it, play with you, sicken you, make you giddy, make you come, intoxicate you, vilify you, make you lean forward in your seat. No. Make you lean forward in your life, waiting for me to actually say the word. And then, like the fool I am, I will say, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, WordFast.
Performance, eh? That's Patricia Smith reading at UNCA's Humanities Lecture Hall about a year ago for WordFest 2008. While she was in town, Patricia stopped by our studios and spoke with Glennis Redman, Sebastian Matthews, and me about her work. Thank you.
You're listening to a special edition of Wordplay, and I'm in the studio with Glennis Redman and Jeff Davis, and our guest today is Patricia Smith. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you. Yes. Glad to be here.
Hi, this is Glennis, and we're kicking off WordFest, and it's pretty amazing to have Patricia Smith back in town. I think it's been about 10 years since she was back in Asheville. I think that was the very first time I saw Patricia Smith, and it was back in the early 90s, I think, mid-90s, and she was phenomenal at the Green Door and at UNCA, and we're just really honored to have her kicking off WordFest today. Yeah. So
it's a treat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Patricia, we're going to ask you to just get this whole thing started, if you would just share a poem with us.
Wow, just like that.
Just like
right
that.
Off the,
yes.
Okay.
Do you mind?
No.
We figured like you were at home, so you could just do that sort of thing. And
No problem at all. Okay, I'm going to do a poem about, I feel kind of jazzy today. So
good.
Okay. I'll do a poem about Dizzy Gillespie, mm-hmm. or for Dizzy Gillespie. Okay. It was never control we were after. Jazz, by ragged definition, pump-started its own heart, sensed the possibilities of chaos long before it became Brown Baby Lullaby, the ripples that pulse on the surface of whiskey. Jazz demanded the unleashing of so many souls, turned order into impetuous melody. Cordwood blues spit at their captors, and there was nowhere to run and even fewer places to hide. What gave birth to jazz? What moist, constricted passage it struggled from? Who held that newborn aloft, slapped that glorious butt, and decided on jazz? It was never control we were after. Jazz, by ragged definition, pump-started its own heart, sensed the possibilities of chaos long before it became Brown Baby Lullaby, the ripples that pulse on the surface of whiskey. Jazz demanded the unleashing of so many souls, turned order into impetuous melody. Cordwood's blues spit at their captors, and there was nowhere to run, and even fewer places to hide. What gave birth to jazz? What moist, constricted passage it struggled from? Who held it aloft, slapped that newborn, and sparked the glorious screaming? Doesn't matter. What matters is fluid lines shredding into scat and us owning that sweetness. What matters is cigarette-thin men swearing at their reflections in the bar top. What matters is sugar browns hitching up homemade skirts and pounding holes into the dance floor, out past curfew and tired of asking the time. What matters is the bee in the bonnet of bebop, curses swirling from the mouth of a sax, moans trapped in cool column of clarinet, the blues twisting a guitar's string throat, and mojo rising up from the brown, battered skin of drums. There is growling in all of this, a warning for you to stop and shout hallelujah from wherever you are, a warning to stop and shout praise to all that is cool and raunchy, a warning to be thankful for complication. And let somebody else answer when the disbelieving ask, who is jazz's mama? What ripe woman body curved and struggled and pushed that hard-headed boy into the light? And somewhere, the bell of a horn curved up. Because it was not about control. It was never about maybe brown babies in sequins and hardback chairs. Jazz was never capture or compliance. It was all about the possibilities of chaos. And he never bothered straightening the bell on that horn, 'cause why shouldn't heaven get the gospel too? What he blew upset us, soured our gentle stomachs. I mean, what did we need with music that thrived in blue light? Music with rumbling in its feet. We begged it to go away, tried to ban it on the airwaves, but as usual, the heat in our hips spoke otherwise. Didn't want to do, didn't never want to do, didn't know how to do without it. Those cocky, seamless blasts that rock us to rolling, because it was not about control. It was never about control. It was about the bell of a horn curved up, not jazz's mama, but her son, all rough chin and shark skin, a black beret on cool kinks, never a note to apologize for, and such outrageous cheeks.
Woo! Yeah. Patricia Smith, award-winning poet, yeah. on the page and stage.
Yeah, and that poem comes from Close to Death?
Yes, yeah. That poem comes from Close to Death.
Yeah. That's a great mm-hmm. poem.
Thank you very much.
I think Patricia is one of the premier persona poets in America.
Thank you very much.
She's phenomenal. She's award-winning. Her work on the stage is equaled only by her work on the page. And I remember hearing about Patricia back in, I think it was before I met her, was like 93. And you were a buzz in the country. And
I was in third grade.
Yeah, that's right. And I was too. And my third grade teacher said, get thee to the poetry festival and partake of Patricia Smith. And, you know, she is one of those people that you had to experience her. And I thought that she was a pioneer, and she always is. She's always one of those poets that's out before the rest of us. And then we all kind of try to play catch up with
her.
Thank
you so much.
Oh, I mean it.
Boy, we're going to have fun tonight.
I'm not surprised that you were both so precocious.
So, Patricia, you want to read that? You said a poem for your daughter, or was it for your son?
Yeah, it was a poem for my son. But you know what?
Something else. I'm changing my mind. Yeah, good.
Yeah, I feel very music-y.
Good.
So this is, you know, my favorite segment of the population are old black men, because you can't get over on anything with them. They've already done everything. You know, it's like
the internet.
It's that kind of stuff. So. And one of my favorite old black men is John Lee Hooker. So this is a poem for John Lee Hooker. And it's called How to Be a Lecherous Little Old Black Man and Make Lots of Money. First, you got to get the blues. This is easy if you are a person of any gender and possess a pulse, a cheating lover, a stalking ex-lover, a used Yugo, a pumping heart, an empty wallet, a half-dead dog, an empty refrigerator, one last cigarette butt, a good memory, a nosy mama, a lonely room, a quick trigger, roving eyes, an addiction to whiskey, nothing but the clothes on your back, a Jones for your neighbor's wife, a Jones for your wife's neighbor, a positive test result, an itching to leave, an itching to stay, or any itching where there shouldn't be one. Rub your hands slow over your body. Feel the valleys and the wrongs. Let misery chomp your spine toward collapsing. Let it fold your whole self double. Then you can walk like John Lee Hooker do. Click shuffle, bent over, nose to the ground, wearing a cocked brim felt fedora that wouldn't dare fall off. Then you can think like John Lee do. I'm old as Victrola. Gotta buy a bottle of Mrs. Butterworth if I want to feel a woman, but I can still sing better than you. You can see the little bottle, Mrs. Butterworth,
yeah,
right?
Oh my God, yes. Yeah.
She freaks me out.
That's a great poem.
Thank you.
Music is a good vibe for today, I think.
I'm a Motown baby.
Yeah.
You know, so my life when I was a kid was pretty much dictated by whatever song was out at the time. And Motown had songs coming out every 2 weeks. You know, so all my ideas about life and love and romance came from that. So I write a lot of, you know, music-based poems.
Yeah. Well, that one, John Lee's one of my old-time favorites, too.
Oh, great. Yeah. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
Patricia, tell us a little bit about where you're living now and what's taken place in the last 10 years since you've been here.
And we've got, what, how many hours?
Well, you got three minutes to do that.
3 minutes, okay. Yeah. I now live in Tarrytown, New York, one of these Norman Rockwell-ish little hamlets, which is actually, it's a little strange. You know, where you'll see nice little racially balanced people playing chess in the town square, you know, and kids riding bikes with little flags on the back, And I've been there probably for about 8 years. It's about half an hour from New York City, which means, you know, I could probably have seen every major American living poet read in New York somewhere. So that's very cool. Awesome. But right now, this is what I do. I travel, I teach, I write, and I'm in an MFA program. I'm about to get out of an MFA program, and we'll be looking for a faculty position. So I am joining the other side.
And if anybody knows anything,
and by the way, I love Asheville and really want a job.
Join the club.
Any MFA directors out there just happen to be listening?
Of course, we'll be reading tonight with one.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. But
Turchy.
I'm doing exactly. I'm doing exactly what I want to be doing right now. Awesome. You know, it's all dedicated toward not only growing as a writer myself, but in helping other people realize that they have, you know, something I like to call the second throat. And the only thing that happened, you know, the only difference between me and someone who doesn't write poetry is that something happened in my life to click that throat loose. And I think we're all very, you know, I think Glennis will attest to this, we're all very fortunate that we found this other way to process our lives and move our lives forward.
I love that idea about That's the second throat, because when I was teaching my workshop at Great Smokies, I totally lifted all you. I'm not going to give you credit, but, you know, I just think that's pretty amazing. Will you expound on that just a little bit more for our readers out there with the second throat?
Yeah, I think I always go back to one of my most magical places nowadays is working with younger kids. And I can't tell you how many times I go into a classroom and you think, oh, I'm here to teach you poetry. And you have to spend the time that you had planned to do something else convincing them that they have legitimate voices, you know, and that anything that they say, any sound that comes out of their mouth is going to be counted. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising how much they've been beaten down and said, well, you know, I'm not going to achieve. I can't, you know, nothing I say. And I think the second throat, people realize that I can't get in front of an audience or a classroom and say, I am poet, you're audience, and, you know, we're going to stay in these roles and I'm going to teach you and you may partake of my knowledge, you know, because I think it's got to be a conversation. And in order for everyone to feel like they're part of that conversation, you have to know that there's nothing really special about the language I use, nothing really special about the choices I make when I sit down and say, this is what I'm going to write about today. I'm writing about things people always talk about, you know. I go into a classroom and listen to the kids buzz when they're coming into the room. So whatever they're talking about, I say, okay, whatever you guys are talking about that happened last night, that's what we're going to write about. And yeah, and every viewpoint and every perspective is going to count, whether it's, you know, two words or if you wind up doing a short story about it, you know. So, and some of us live our whole lives and never discover that we have that outlet and that throat. And I think what we try to do is to get at least one person in every audience to go home and grab a pen and say, I can do that.
So you're validating their existence, like by the buzz, like listening to what they're saying.
Yeah.
Just like saying what you say, what you do matters.
Yes. Right.
And not just matters, but actually it can be song or it could be like perform. That it could take it and it could be material right now.
We're not going to worry about the structure. You know, you have a story to tell, that story could be poured into any form at all, you know.
I have a question to you that's aside from that. I'm kind of going way back. I'm asking you about the poem Skinhead.
Okay.
That is going.
I just want to ask you, I mean, I was teaching Persona, it was like, when I remember hearing you do that for the first time, and I think you were probably the first person I realized who spoke in another voice, and it was like, wow, I didn't know. And I think you blew many people's mind that you could do that. And my question to you is like, where did it come from? How did you know? I mean,
the really basic thing about Skinhead was somebody painted a swastika on Plymouth Rock. And if any of you have been anywhere near New England, you do not mess with the rock.
Yeah.
And they couldn't find who did it, but they narrowed it down to this group, and they found this one member of the group, and he was spewing all this hatred at blacks, Jews, you know, and it would be easy to dismiss him and say, what an idiot, and go on with your life. But I thought, you know, we both started in the same place, and for some reason he veered off this way, and I veered off that way, and I want to write a poem to attempt to bring us back to some common spot. And having worked for years as a journalist, you try to figure out ways to get as close to your story as you can. Mm-hmm. And the first thing I try to do, I don't think many poets don't spend enough time looking for an unexpected entry point into their poems.
Right.
They just, you know, we're writing off emotion, so we sit down and we start writing.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's really important to get myself out of the way. So if I'm going to create a life for this person or even a moment in his life, I have to let him tell me how he wants to live it. I can't put my own self in it that deeply and say, okay, I'm Patricia Smith and I'm writing this and you will always hear me and see my presence in this poem.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting out of the way. And it doesn't work all the time. I had a persona poem, a fixation for a while where all of them, I just wanted to get in the story. And it doesn't always work. You have to kind of pick and choose. And I think what led me to make the choice with this one was that the extra added visual
mm-hmm.
that there's a black woman in this voice comes from. And after a while, I developed an accent, and I don't know where it came from, you know, or I would close my eyes and then open them and be like 5 feet away from where the mic was, and I'd gotten over there. And I'm a real believer in how powerful persona can be if you stop looking at it as a poetic device and open yourself to it and realize that the people you choose to write about really do want to tell their stories, but you have to be a conduit.
Mm.
You know, you're not always in control of that situation.
Yeah, it seems like one of the riskiest things, maybe a feeling of it being one of the riskiest things that you can do, that kind of empathy. And then once you do it, it seems to be essential. I mean, hearing you talk about it.
Well, even if you're not writing in persona, you have to take the time to step into everyone's shoes in whatever you're writing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, we often we see things in newspapers and it's not necessarily something we've ever experienced. We feel enough that we know we want to write. And of course, there's little touches of you in there, the word choices that you're making, things like that. But there is I just think of myself as a tunnel sometimes, especially when a story has really been pushing at me to write this. It's like, okay, but I want to write it, but you have to start me off, or you have to tell me, you have to say something to me.
Yeah.
Sometimes I work with students and have them put a picture. We write personas of you know, we just get a picture out of the paper or something, and they don't know anything about the person. I said, oh, put it up in your mirror when you're getting ready in the morning, or put it in your wallet or something. And then when it begins to say, my name is boom, you know, and then you just go from there. Sounds kind of supernatural,
but it
works.
Yeah. We have a time for either one more question or one more poem. I think we're kind of,
I think we should go with a poem.
Yeah.
I mean, I wanted to ask you what's pushing at you now, but let's go to,
I should do like a little short poem and then I can tell you what's pushing at me now. Can I do a little political poem?
Oh, please
sure.
do.
Sure.
You know, because I've been on some places where I start and I go, the war and the...
you're in Asheville.
Oh, okay. Especially.
Yeah.
All right. This is a poem called Giving Birth to Soldiers. And there's a little tiny news item. February 1st, 2005, Tabitha Bonilla's husband, Army Captain Orlando A. Bonilla, was killed Wednesday in a helicopter accident in Baghdad. Her father, Army Sergeant First Class Henry Bacon, died in Iraq last February. She will pin ponderous medals to her house dress, dripping the repeated roses, while she claws through boxes filled with him and then him. The accepting of God's weird wisdom takes place over forkfuls of rubbery casseroles and the snowy vows of newsmen who measure her worth in cued weeping. She offers her husband's hands, a shrine of their mingled smells, a warm seat on a couch of napped corduroy. They offer one polished bone scrubbed clean of war. And she babbles of links and irony, shrugs her numb shoulders, and feels dimly blessed as a door slams shut on both sides of her head. Suddenly, she is her only history. Smiling politely beneath a fierce salute, propped upright behind the crumpled ghost of her men, she is the catchy logo for a confounded country. This is the day she has. Tomorrow she will touch her own breast. She will dismantle a gaudy altar with her teeth. And she will ask a bemused God for guidance as she steps back into line, her womb tingling vaguely with the next soldier.
Nice poem.
Thank you very much.
That was the phenomenal Patricia Smith.
Oh, thank you, Miss Phenomenal Glynis.
Say a few things about Glynis's question. It sounded like you had an answer for it.
Oh, what's on my mind right now?
Yeah.
Another little news item that I found that I just got it, folded it up, and kept moving it around on my desk, put it in the pocket, put it in my purse, and I knew. There's a little news item. A man, 85-year-old man's wife had died of cancer about two or three years before. And her voice was on their answering machine greeting. And every day he would walk to the corner store and use the payphone and call the house to hear her voice on the phone. And that would be enough. But then Verizon updated his service and wiped the message off of the machine.
Oh.
Oh,
and that's the poem that I'm working on.
Oh, man.
That's
so powerful.
I didn't mean to bring everybody down. I know. Isn't that?
That's kind of beautiful, though.
Yeah.
Patricia, it's great to have you.
Thank you. I can't wait
to hear you read tonight.
Oh, thanks so much.
7 o'clock.
Hillary will be there.
Yes, she will.
Yeah.
I mean, won't let her in, actually.
Yeah. Come to the Humanities Hall at UNCA and hear Patricia Smith's.
Yes. And
you'll be forever changed.
I think so. This is Wordplay. And again, thanks for coming.
This is Wordplay on WPVM 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains. I'm your host, Jeff Davis.
Traveling through this world alone, got no place of my own. Living down here on borderland, on borderland. Ain't got no place to call my own. Don't turn me from your door, me from your door, baby.
And that's Wordplay for this week. Tune in next week for more poetry on the airwaves and the ether. And do check out some of Wordfest. You can get the complete schedule at AshevilleWordFest.org. There are lots of good poets coming into town. Quincy Troop, Lee Jung Lee, Ross Gay, Leanne Brown, David Hopes, Coleman Barks, Thomas Rinkrow, and many, many others. So do check it out.
I got a home, home on high, in another world, in another world. I'm a stranger, I'm traveling through the land, don't turn me away, don't turn me away, I'm traveling, baby, I'm a stranger, baby, knocking.